This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4.
Hello and welcome to today's programme. I hope you had a good weekend. Over mine, I seem to have inadvertently stumbled into one of the biggest debates of all time. So big I didn't even know it was a debate. Whether to wear knickers or not under your pyjama bottoms. To me, it's crystal clear. Of course you do, but according to clothing guru Susanna Constantine, she of Trini and Susanna fame, you do not. Perhaps you can help me out here. I see no debate, but apparently I'm in the minority. On today's programme, apart from your answers to that burning question, of course, we shall be hearing from one of the key women from the UK Vaccine Task Force, who's just been awarded an OBE for her efforts, Divya Chadamanak. 30 years on from the seminal Thelma and Louise film, what's changed? And men standing up for women in the workplace, hope or reality? Your stories, please. 84844 is the number you need to text. Social media at BBC Woman's Hour or email us your views, your take through our website. We look forward to hearing them. But to our first guest this morning, Amanda Spielman, Chief Inspector of Ofsted England's Schools Watchdog. The latest report from her team, which may have caught your eye, found that sexual harassment and online sexual abuse are such a routine part of school children's lives, in particular schoolgirls, that they don't see any point in challenging or reporting it. That, along with debates over how girls dress at school, whether children should be vaccinated or not, or even whether there should be head girls, means there's a lot for her to talk about and think about, and a lot for us to ask about. Chief Inspector of Ofsted, Amanda Spielman, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us today. Before we get to the experience of schoolgirls that your inspectors have been looking at, let's get to just that, girls. Over the weekend, it emerged that St Paul's Girls' School in London is doing away with the head girl term as it's too binary. There will now be a head of school instead of head girl. Do you agree?
I think it's so sad if girls can't be proud of being girls. There's so much debate, isn't there? And it always seems to focus on girls and whether girls or women can be characterised that way. So I just hope that St Paul's Girls' School and every other girls' school can carry on encouraging most of their girls. Of course, there'll always be a few exploring their sexuality, exploring gender, but let's hope that girls can carry on being proud of being girls.
So no need for head of school, should be allowed to be head girl.
Any individual school, it's for them to make their choice. But I love to see girls being proud of being girls.
Because you were at that school, is that right, as well? Just as an added element to this?
For sixth form, yes.
You were. So your personal response to that as a former member is also quite interesting.
Yes, I haven't spoken to others about it, I have to say.
OK, because just to say, St Paul's Girls' School, a spokesperson said, it's reported that they said it was a suggestion of our senior students that we change the name from head girl to head of school as more modern, age appropriate and inclusive. Quote, in doing so, we're returning to our roots. From our very foundation in 1904 and for decades afterwards, a senior student was called head of school. So in making the change, we're confirming, not denying, our ethos and traditions. What do you make of that as an answer for it?
Well, that's very much down to the individual school and considerations. I'd just like to make sure that the power and strength of girls and being a woman growing into being a woman doesn't get lost in our society. It's so important.
Are you worried about that with what you see across schools? Because you have a very unique vantage point.
I think all the discussion we've seen about sex and gender, is it can get very heated, very sensitive, and is probably making it a bit harder for young people to grow up. It's adding extra dimensions of complexity for them. So my interest and in the subject we're just coming on to is very much about how do we help young people grow up healthily and well and sort of take full part in adult life, including getting control of their sexuality as it develops. So let's concentrate on doing everything we can to help them grow up well.
Well, it's not necessarily sexuality. We're talking about perhaps gender identity as well here. And I suppose the other point to put there, though, which when reading around this, is what if there's a generational gap here? What if this suggestion is coming from the girls? Because St Paul's is a girls' school, so I'll just say girls in this instance, but of course from pupils generally. What would you say that perhaps they feel this is more inclusive?
Well, I think on many issues and for many generations, we've had the same trend of the young are often the most motivated, the most radical, the most inclined to find a cause. And all of us, as we mature and get older, perhaps start looking at things with a different perspective. So who knows whether there is a genuine intergenerational change or whether it's just another manifestation of that strength and intensity that it's absolutely right that we want young people to have, that will moderate with time. I simply don't know. I don't have a crystal ball to look into the future.
There was one more story to ask you about before we get to that report, but I think it's very important because of what you're trying to do in this report. Another story in The Telegraph at the end of last week was around the advice from Stonewall, the LGBT charity, that teachers should drop the terms boys and girls in favour of learners. Would you support that, Amanda Spielman?
I think it's very important that we talk about children in sort of natural language. The more we shift away from the kinds of words that mothers, fathers, children, teachers naturally use, the more remote things get, and the harder it is for people to think about them. So I'm very much in favour of using natural, comfortable terminology,
which wouldn't be learners. You would seek to continue have teachers saying boys and girls.
Learners is used quite extensively in education legislation, precisely of the difficulty of having a concise catch-all term for every situation. But it also distances and can make it easy to forget that there are real live children and young people underneath. So that's why in everything that I talk about, I do my best to use the human terms that people actually think in and relate to.
But that's very interesting, because a spokesperson for Stonewall Charity told The Telegraph it was very proud of all of its work supporting schools to create supportive and inclusive environments, which helps everyone feel accepted for who they are. And they added that they are confident that the advice that they give to schools is robust and in line with the Department for Education's guidance for schools in England and the Equality and Human Rights Commission's Equality Act Code of practice, although of course we have just learnt recently that the Equality and Human Rights Commission left the LGBT charity, left Stonewall, their programme for its own uses in March, citing concerns over value for money, just to put that reference into context. But they're talking about making it inclusive, and you're saying it's not natural language.
I haven't reviewed the Stonewall guidance that's being given to schools. It's not for us to do that. I'm talking about a sort of general principle. I think the more we talk about things in familiar terms, the more likely people are to absorb their messages. So there may be times when it's appropriate for schools, for example, simply to talk about children. There may be times when it's appropriate for them to talk about boys and girls. I'm not prescribing. It's never for Ofsted to prescribe what schools do, but I do recognize the importance of having people absorb what you're talking about is the prime consideration. What is most helpful given the message that you're trying to get across?
A message has come in from Steph, who's listening. Good morning, saying I agree with Amanda Spielman. Girls should be proud of being girls. Females are already less visible, and initiatives such as this makes them less so, I think in reference to our first discussion about head girls. So that message just come in from Steph. That in mind, and also with what you have just said, let's come to this report that you were asked to compile by the government. Rapidly so, after thousands of harrowing testimonies detailing sexual abuse and misconduct in schools were posted on the Everyone's Invited website earlier this year. Were you surprised by your findings?
Surprise is not quite the right word. We were aware that there was a significant problem building up in young people's lives. Others have been doing work over this in the past few years. I think we were surprised by the extent to which this had become a substantial problem for such an enormous proportion of girls especially. And I think we were also surprised by the imbalance between the level of the scale of the problem in any given school or college and school awareness of it. Part of this is because this bleeds across between children's lives in school and out of school. Pre-smartphone technology, perhaps that there was a much clearer distinction between in school and out of school. Now the things sort of bleed into each other. So although many of the sort of specific distressing incidents we heard about had happened outside school, the consequences of those, and sometimes sharing of images or video from them, bled across into people's school lives and were making them so very uncomfortable even at school because they were there with other people who'd been part of the same incident.
I mean, just to remind people who are listening, who will have read the report, perhaps not recalled necessarily all the details, but 9 out of 10 girls that your inspector spoke to said that sexist name calling was part of life, and that they were being sent unwanted explicit pictures or videos, that happened a lot or sometimes. And as I said in my introduction, happening so much that almost they don't see any point in reporting it or challenging it. And I suppose that's what makes your job right now very difficult into how to advise schools with what to do about it. Because the central recommendation, as I understand from your review, is schools must assume now abuse and harassment is happening to their pupils.
Yes, and it's a strong and unpalatable message. But we visited 32 schools and colleges, and there wasn't a single one that wasn't significantly affected by these problems. So there were some schools which thought that they didn't have a problem, and yet our conversations with their pupils said yes, they do. Similarly, we talked to a number of local authority, local area safeguarding partnerships, and a couple of those thought it wasn't a problem in their area. What's come across very strongly for us is that this really is universal. So every school, every college does need to operate on the premise that from a startlingly young age, a significant proportion of young people will be affected. So the work that they can do to build a healthy culture, to do really good relationship and sex education, which came across from young people as often being an area of weakness, where the right issues weren't really being talked about, or the people who were teaching those lessons weren't really confident and competent to do so. So that a very firm handle to make sure that this is addressed as strongly as possible from a relatively young age.
What age do you think discussions of pornography should be introduced?
Well, we certainly heard that young people by the age of 13 or so, a very large proportion of young people had seen at least some pornographic material. Basically, once children have smartphones, it's very, very hard to stop them seeing pornographic material. And natural curiosity, when you start to hear people talking about things, children just are very curious. And we did hear in some schools, we visited a couple of primary schools, and some of the schools were all through schools. Even we heard about younger children in the older age groups in primary school using some highly sexualized language, clearly showing familiarity with things that it was quite concerning that children at that age should be aware of and bringing into their games and conversation.
So what age do you think it should be formally discussed by teachers? It's an important question, not least because a question that's come in here for you, one of our listeners has got in touch to say, one of the main issues seems to be girls feeling pressured into sharing and receiving explicit photos, and this is normalised. How can this be challenged?
And this is a very big problem. You talked about the kinds of problem that were at the top of young people's minds, especially girls. And one strand was the things that been going on for a very long time that most of us can remember from school, sexist name calling, sort of inappropriate comments, rumours about girls' sexual activity. But the other strand has been unlocked in the last decade, and sort of being able to take nude photographs of yourself or being put under pressure to do so. That's really a new thing, and it's so many girls do say that this has happened to them or to their friends. And it's very hard for them to resist. So this is one of the things they really want sex education in school to do, both to help them understand, sort of strengthen their ability to risk, but also they rightly say it shouldn't be their job to educate boys. So to get stronger messages into sex education for boys about
what age do you think sexting, porn, and this whole terrain, which is the new element of this, what age, Amanda Spielman, should that be coming in at?
Well, from the point, if you're willing to give a child a smartphone, you should be educating them from that age. We seem to be in an era where most children have smartphones from the beginning or relatively early in secondary school. So you probably do need to do it there
from 11.
I don't want to be precise and say that it has to be from year 7, and it's a matter from government, but at the earlier end of secondary school, not the later end. I heard about one parent I spoke to said that their daughter's school was doing this in year 11. That's clearly too late. I think
earlier. If you hear about porn only when you're 16, that is extremely late, and what you've just described as the landscape, or anyone who's got anything to do with young people.
So this is something at the early end of primary school, and obviously that adolescence, puberty, adolescence kick in around that sort of 11, 12, 13 age. So that probably is the age you really need to start talking about these stuff. And in some ways, you want to get in ahead of pornography, don't you? To start talking about healthy relationships and the boundaries of acceptable behaviour before. Young people start experimenting for themselves rather than after.
If you're just joining us, I am with the Chief Inspector of Ofsted, which is England's schools watchdog, Amanda Spielman. Is this safe to say inspectors are not always teachers' favourite people? Is it safe to say that you're now going to include, having done this report, this element of safeguarding and changing culture as part of what you mark schools on?
We have always included all the different aspects of bullying, behaviour problems and safeguarding in our inspections. But what we started doing from 2017 onwards was strengthening the inspector's training, introducing specific requirements to ask schools about reports of sexual harassment and violence. And what we're doing in the light of this is to strengthen the expectation on inspectors to really push on this one, because one of the things that came out of introducing a requirement to ask schools for this ahead of inspection was we discovered only, I think it was 6% of schools gave us anything in response to that request, and nearly half the others gave us a nil return, essentially saying we haven't had any reports. So comparing this with what we hear from young people, it says that this point about so much not getting reported is desperately important here. And we went into this in some depth. And partly young people are concerned that they won't be believed or simply don't think anything would be done, which is very worrying. There's also a strand about worrying that they'll be blamed because they have done something that they know an adult has told them not to do, like sharing a nude image, even though they may have been put under considerable pressure to do so. Or they can fear that once they talk to an adult, the process will be out of their control. And this is a great desire. Young people don't like processes like this going out of control when it's talking about something that's incredibly difficult and personal. So helping them understand better exactly what will and won't happen when they report does matter.
I was just going to say, a few listeners getting in touch also say, you know, don't forget the role of parents there. It can't all be on teachers. And, you know, you're talking there, of course, about widespread culture. But what has been put on teachers lately, or certainly some of the stories that there've been a proliferation around, is around girls at school and uniform and the idea of modesty shorts for girls as young as 4 so they don't show their knickers when wearing summer dresses or doing sport. We've read reports of girls being publicly dressed down also for tight skirts, which are apparently allowed under certain school uniform policies. We've also heard about a school, even in Wales, that's banned girls from wearing skirts as they're too short. We began our conversation talking about girls. What do you make of the rise of this sort of thing and modesty shorts?
I was a bit sad to read that report because it felt as though it was getting close to victim blaming. We were talking about primary age children and potentially sort of saying they shouldn't be children, they shouldn't be doing cartwheels in the playground or whatever, unless they had sort of extra layers of protective clothing on. I found that rather sad. I'd much rather concentrate on addressing the culture and the problem that could lead to concerns about it, rather than sort of blaming very young girls for doing what comes naturally to children. So that's a bit of a sad one.
I know. I suppose it's also, you know, looking at this whole culture, what's feeding into schools and what's feeding into children's mind from all of this. So you find it sad, but I suppose if it's coming from teachers, do you just trust that schools will sort it out? If it's coming from our wider culture, it's not necessarily the teacher's fault, but are you worried about this becoming a trend?
Well, it circles back round to perhaps even in primary schools, there may be a need to start addressing some of these issues quite early. If girls are feeling uncomfortable in primary school about remarks being made by at that point very young boys, we really need to get to think about what we do that. And you're quite right. There is a partnership between schools and parents. What we've seen over the last decade is an expansion of that grey area that sits between what parents oversee directly and what schools oversee directly, which has always been there in adolescence for secondary age children, but it's got bigger and more complicated and harder. So school parents and schools taking their responsibilities seriously and recognising the difficulties here is so important.
Just finally, because this was a big theme when we were talking about the everyone invited testimonies that then led to your report. What do you make around punishment for boys? So some say necessary to change the culture, but is it fair to single individuals out when, quote, they're all doing it or lots of them are doing it, with potentially massive impact on boys who are still children too?
There can be massive impact at both ends here. And what we've tried to do with this report is to help get the language, the expression, the discussion in a way that recognises, as indeed the government guidance does, that both in relation to the young person doing something that they shouldn't do, and in relation to the person at the receiving end, that there is a spectrum of seriousness, and schools have to judge and use their skill and expertise and knowledge of the circumstances to judge the proportionate response on both for both the doer and the receiver, and that is really, really important, because if you want to change the culture, everybody's got to listen, boys and girls, and everybody's got to feel that things are being fairly dealt with so that they don't get sort of entrenched and embattled in corners. You don't achieve that by using sort of really pejorative terms. You don't achieve that by over-responding to an individual incident any more than you do by under-responding. So it's a tough job here to try and find that balance that encourages young people, that deals with the things that the specific incidents that need addressing, without disappearing down a rabbit hole of extreme language and response to every incident, and almost sort of losing sight of that important culture piece about growing up healthily.
It sounds like an absolute minefield. The teacher's got the training to do this.
Well, this is why one of our recommendations is around relationships and sex education. I said, I think it's very unfair actually to expect every teacher to be an expert in relationship and sex education. Sometimes schools simply put this in tutor time and expect every teacher with a tutor group or class to teach it. But we wouldn't expect every teacher to teach a maths lesson in tutor time. So why in an area requiring a sort of different expertise, would we just say everybody must do it? So making sure schools really do, I think, need to focus on making sure that they've not just got a good curriculum here, and the new government guidance that's been slightly delayed by COVID but is just coming in, is pretty good here, I think is a real step forward. But also make sure that it's being taught by people who've got the training and the willingness to do it. Not everybody can feel comfortable and confident talking about these kind of issues with teenagers. All of us can remember
all the time. It's not about confidence, it's about the time. I mean, the teachers are absolutely, you know, some of them have been saying to us on air, it's been the hardest time ever And they've been obviously trying to do all sorts of other things as well. So never mind just the training, also the time. I'm sure many people will be getting in touch that I can see so many are on the things that we've spoken about. Thank you for your time and your answers this morning. Amanda Spearman, I'm sure we'll have you back on as things develop, the Chief Inspector of Ofsted, which is, of course, the England schools watchdog. Some messages just to do off the back of that, because so many have come in. Who wants to be called a girl at 18, says Lisa. Head of school, just going back to that debate, still celebrates the whole person. Amanda Spearman seems blissfully unaware how many teenagers prefer non-binary terms. Boys and girls is only natural to her because she's always used it. Language constantly changes. On the idea of when we should start talking to children about porn, ban smartphones for primary school kids and strongly discourage for younger secondary. Wouldn't that make everybody's life easier? And another message along the lines around modesty shorts or so-called modesty shorts. My two primary school age daughters always wear shorts under their school dresses. These are not modesty shorts, but basic common sense and liberates them. And another one, my daughter's school secondary insisted on them wearing ridiculous pencil skirts to knee. It was like office wear. Who wears that in an office now? This meant it was inevitable that girls folded up the waistband, not least because they couldn't walk fast enough across a big campus to get to class. So-called sports-focused schools effectively killed all girls' sports in breaks, as they could no longer play football. Even semi-pro footballers stopped playing in school. No one wanted to wear girls' trousers as they were hideous for camel toe and very uncool. Tried to address it, but I was rebuffed by a very old-fashioned needlework teacher who was given the role of designing the uniform. And so it carries on. More messages around what do we do around how we even refer to girls and how we dress them in school and what we do around this issue. Thank goodness for some sense from Amanda with regards to language. Children are going to get so muddled by all of this nonsense. Those messages coming in still. Keep them coming on 84844. It is 30 years next month, believe it or not, since the release of the iconic female road movie, Thelma and Louise.
Thelma.
Thelma, haven't I told you I can't stand it when you holler in the morning?
I'm sorry, doll. I just didn't want you to be late.
Hey, how you doing, little housewife?
Louise.
Yeah, I still have to ask Daryl if I can go.
You mean you haven't asked him yet? Thelma, is he your husband or your father?
Thelma and Louise are going fishing.
How come Daryl let you go?
Because I didn't ask him.
He's going to kill you!
I left him a note.
Thelma and Louise are going to catch hell.
I'll have a wild turkey straight up and a Coke back, please.
Thelma?
Oh, what? Tell me something. Is this my vacation or isn't it?
With me to talk about why this film matters after three decades and why you should see it if you haven't, film critic Karen Krasanovich. Why is it still a big deal, do you think, three decades on, Karen, Thelma and Louise?
Well, because you and me, Emma, in a car. I'll tell you why, because there's some fantastic lines in this movie and it's still all about female empowerment, even, you know, so many years later. You are what you settle for. That is the whole message of Thelma and Louise.
And in the sense of why it was so and how it was so groundbreaking, not just those lines, take us back to that.
Oh my gosh. Well, don't forget now, Ridley Scott was coming out of The Duelist, which is a very male-centric film, was given a script. A friend of a friend gave him the script by Callie Corey. It was the first script. And he didn't want to direct it initially, but Michelle Pfeiffer told him to. So we ended up with Geena Davis and Susan Sarandon in the leads. And this is about two women sort of on the run. They end up being on the run, pursued by Harvey Keitel. And it's a story about female friendship, about doing the right thing, about having one heck of a holiday. But it really does have some wonderful lines. For example, one of the women heckles a sexist truck driver and shows, "My husband wasn't sweet to me and look how I turned out." You know, there's just some fantastic lines.
Of course. I mean, it's interesting to read as well that the two women have been reunited over the weekend. Yeah. And they have been talking, Geena Davis and Susan Sarandon, of course, propelled to new heights of stardom by this, but have been talking about the fact that they thought this was going to be such a moment, that there were going to be so many movies starring women, about women, female road pictures. And they say they're still waiting.
Yeah, well, we're all still waiting. The fact that you've got two women that are they're a lead in basically what Susan Sarandon said she thought was going to be a cowboy movie, outlaw movie, it shocked a lot of particularly male critics and a lot of I think males enjoy it now. I think they were kind of the fact that women were taking revenge on somebody that was violent toward them seemed wrong, And I think Sarandon said they got all offended because one of us accused of his glorifying murder and suicide said it didn't seem like a big deal, but apparently it was, but not enough to make this film what you would typically see in the cinema afterwards.
And do you think, though, I mean, because that backlash is something people discuss around it. I don't know if you do see it as valid.
Always.
Do you see it as valid, first of all, on that?
Insofar as how much violence do we want, why should we continue to find violence exciting and entertaining? That is one question. But I think having the turnaround of women taking their revengeance on men, on their vengeance on men, when they're being attacked, it's almost like a fantasy, really. And I can see why men at the time got upset, but now it has kind of made that a little bit more acceptable. But films like Thelma and Louise are funny, and they're also exciting, and they also have important points. And we very rarely get that in a film.
And still two female leads quite like that is still newsworthy.
Two very strong female leads, with Brad Pitt being introduced. Just a little bit of eye candy. I can say eye candy. I know it's sexist.
You said it. There you go. I'm not sure you can for some people, but that's the whole debate around this, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm afraid it is. There's a lot of sexist fingers being pointed at Thelma and Louise, and also that Ridley Scott gave his sons all of the stunt cars. And Susan Sarandon said, we should have got those cars.
Oh, well, there you go. I've stumbled into another debate. You don't necessarily have to answer this, but I have been getting a lot of messages. I do need to return to it. Unwittingly, I stumbled into this about whether you wear knickers under your pyjamas or not. And I always thought it was very clear that you did, but I'm being told I've really, really lost the plot on this one. Karen, you look uncomfortable on Zoom as I'm asking you this. It's not why we booked you.
No, that's absolutely fine. I was thinking I don't own a pair of pyjamas. Sorry.
So you're not going to help me out. Karen Krasanovich, thank you very much. If you haven't seen Thelma and Louise, perhaps it's time, 30 years on. Sue on my question here says, definitely no knickers under pyjamas. Definitely. Another one here, though. Knickers under pyjamas. If you don't wear knickers, then surely you have to wash your PJ bottoms every day. Exactly, Di. Personally, I just wear knickers and I don't bother with the PJs anyway. Well, of course, that's an option, especially when it was hot for just 1 minute in this country. What, knickers under nightwear? Never. As a nighty wearer, I find the comfort of Nicholasness. I'm happy I said that. A bedtime pleasure. Try it, Emma. You might enjoy it, says Jane in Chester. Good morning to you. Thanks for the tip. Mary's not happy at all with me. Knickers under pyjamas, a dirty, unhygienic habit. The tyranny of nuns to teach shame about our bodies, like wearing knickers in the bath. I did not know that one. Yvette, though, definitely no pants underneath if you must wear PJs. Let it air, for goodness sake, and keep that thrush at bay. Very practical tips here. Thank you. But I don't want to wash my PJ bottoms every day. Sorry. There you go. Okay, back to what we've been discussing. Of course, though, that's very important. And thank you for coming in. It does seem to be I'm in the minority here, but if you wear those knickers, let me know. 84844. And a lot of you also getting in touch around our discussions of language and what's going on in schools and the pressure on girls and boys. I'll come back to that very, very shortly indeed. And of course, any memories of Thelma and Louise. Actually, just one here. Judith says, I dislike this film intensely. I thought it was the opposite of feminist, particularly the ending. Am I alone? So this is the thing, Judith. You can think you're completely in the majority and then you hear something else and it takes you somewhere else. We'll see if we get an answer to that, Judith. Thank you for that message. But my next guest, Divya Chadamanik, was given a clear message by her dad when she came to the UK from India as a teenager. And it would seem she's made good on it, having just been listed for an OBE for her work on the UK Vaccine Task Force. She's been highly praised for encouraging companies to work in the UK and then overseeing the rollout of the vaccine trials. Good morning, Divya, and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Emma.
I just want to go back to what your dad said, bearing in mind it's just been Father's Day as well. What did he say to you about coming to the UK?
Well, this was when I was young, you know, 18. And sometimes I think he was kind of pushing me out the door at that age when you're off to university. And he said to me, gave me some money and said to me at the airport, you know, make sure you do good, make sure you're always good, and make sure you do something so amazing that you get to meet the Queen. You know, absolute royal fan. So he to us, you know, at least to him, it was really important that you, if you do good, you actually go and get to meet the Queen. So when this honor came in, it kind of the first thing that at first I said, well, is this true? And the second thing was, oh, wow, I've, you know, that this is very close to what he actually said to me. So, yeah.
But he's not here to be able to share this news with.
No, my father passed away in December. So to me, the fact that I only heard about it not too long ago just hit home that I've been able to do something that he wanted me to do. And fingers crossed, he's hopefully proud of me.
Well, I'm sure, but also a very striking moment, I'm sure, for you to think back to his words and what you have been doing. And although I'm sure the last 15 months you haven't really had space or time to think because of how frantic it's been, I tried to explain a little of what you have been doing on that task force. Can you tell us what your job was?
Yeah, sure. So in May last year, I was seconded out from my original role, which was I was head of business development at the National Institute of Health Research. So my day job at that time before I was seconded was to convince companies to come and do more clinical research in the UK, life sciences companies, pharma, medtech, CRO, everyone to come and do more research. And so because of this kind of aspect of my job, I was Kate Bingham called me and said, you know, did a 5-minute interview and said, we need someone to oversee all the COVID vaccine studies. Would you be...
If I made Kate Bingham the head of the vaccines task force, in case people don't know her name.
Yes, sorry, Dame Kate Bingham. Now.
Indeed.
The chair of the vaccine task force at that moment in May, you know, asked me whether I would be interested in coming and supporting the work of the vaccine task force. So the National Institute of Health Research very happily gave my time. And I had two things to do. The first thing was to convince the manufacturers, the vaccine manufacturers, to come and place their clinical trials in the UK. So, you know, the world is a marketplace. These companies can run their trials anywhere in the world. My job was to say, come to the UK because of the great science we've got, because of the NHS, because of the research capability and the workforce, to convince them to come and run their trials here. And then the second bit was then overseeing that portfolio of research of the trials that were happening in the UK and then kind of making good on that promise of kind of convincing them. So that was the key crux of my work.
What were the
main... It wasn't just my work, though. That's most important. It was a massive team effort.
Of course. But what was the thrust of the feedback on that? Was there reticence to come?
Absolutely not. I think people were... We had to create the vaccine task force and the National Institute for Health Research had to kind of step up the research ecosystem to ensure that we were competitive. So, for example, the two key aspects were, well, how do we need to set these studies up pretty quickly. So the regulatory environment, the MHRA or the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, which I think now everyone is, it's a household name at the moment, isn't it?
Yes. The interesting MHRA, times we're living in. Yes.
Interesting time. So MHRA, the Health Research Authority, the HR, the regulatory agencies then stepped up and said, OK, we're going to fast track COVID applications to get the regulatory approvals done quickly. The National Institute for Health Research said, OK, well, how can we collectively work on getting recruitment done quickly? So the NHS vaccine registry was created and you know, a huge thank you. We have more than 500,000 people signed up to this registry because without, you know, the crux of clinical research is that we need the volunteers as fast as possible. So the response, I guess, from the vaccine manufacturers when we were trying to kind of sell UK PLC for research essentially was, well, we had stepped up the infrastructure and other countries particularly hadn't. So this was our opportunity to shine and bring the research in. So there was a lot of interest to place the studies in the UK.
Talking of household names, as someone who's had this role on the vaccine task force, and you know, with people feeling certainly like perhaps within, if I was to paraphrase how our response has been, there's a great deal of consternation about how our response certainly was early on. But the vaccine part of it is the bit that a lot of people are feeling more positive about, although they've asked questions of if they've been double jabbed, for instance, why can't they travel and all of those things. But if you were to just look at the household names that we now have, Moderna, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and I was reading a piece only this morning by Zoe Williams in The Guardian, who was talking about we've got vaccine tribes now. And, you know, have you had the AstraZeneca? Oh, how do you feel about that? Have you had Pfizer? And Pfizer, how it's stored, seems to have, you know, a kind of higher status. What do you make of the way that those names have passed into common parlance and the way people are talking about it with each other?
I absolutely love it. If anything, such a positive story out of COVID-19 is the fact that this is all clinical research and the importance of research are all household names. Let me tell you a story. When I went to get my vaccine,
who are
I
you?
Had my first
who are you? Which tribe are you?
Oh, I'm AstraZeneca. Okay. I'm AstraZeneca. So you can akin it, isn't it? When someone delivers a baby and the first question you ask, is it a boy or is it a girl? That's the first question. Have you had your vaccine?
Which one
did you have?
What flavor?
But actually, when I went and I was already emotional, for me, it was an emotional moment. You know, it felt like I played a little role in actually me going up and having my own vaccine. So it was very emotional. I took my daughter along with me. And as I was sat in the waiting area, there was a lady who came in, was having a very vocal conversation with the pharmacist, asking the pharmacist what vaccines were available that day. And the pharmacist was saying, actually, we've got AstraZeneca and that's what we've got at the moment. And the lady was saying, well, can you tell me, for me as an individual, which vaccine should I have? Because I've seen the news about, she quoted another vaccine and she said, well, this is this percentage effective. And the research has shown that this is this percent effective. And I had such a huge grin on my face when I heard this, because to me, it's like, well, when have we ever taken a tablet and said, well, how much research has gone into this? Or put a cream on our body and said, you know, how much research has gone into this? So the importance of clinical research and what it is doing for us is incredible. So that to me is the huge plus point, if anything, from the pandemic and from the vaccine response specifically, is the highlight of how important research is. And hopefully that will drive people to want to take part in research, because you can actually see the outputs of what we do.
Just to say on that though, then, how do you feel? I mean, last week the news was dominated by the fact that COVID vaccinations are to become compulsory for staff at care homes in England. What do you make about that as someone who fought to work with the vaccines to get them going here?
Well, I'm not an expert here, so I hold my hand up and I'm not going to comment on specifics of it is. But I think what is really important is all the questions that we do get, all the questions, you know, big topics, every day is a new topic. You know, will children get vaccinated? Will we have a third dose? All of those different questions that we ask, there is only one answer out of this. And the answer is by doing clinical research and by having the results of it. So by volunteering, you know, we already have an incredible 500,000 people who have signed up for the NHS Vaccine Research Registry. We still have a huge amount of research that's there, that's ongoing. An important study that's ongoing, people may not know this, an important clinical study that's ongoing is the COV boost study, which is literally looking at people who've had two doses and now a third dose. But unless we have volunteers who step up and sign up to these studies, we won't have the answers to all the questions. Should we make them compulsory? Should we not? Should we give it to children? All of those questions that people ask. So I'm not the scientist, so I can't answer the questions. But the important bit is that unless people play a role in clinical research, we're not going to make our way out of the pandemic.
I suppose then, not on the actual research though, but a question to you around the reasoning, if you like, behind that, which is the concern that some people and certain groups are not taking up the vaccine. How concerned does that make you? You know, the latest data, for instance, you know, on the Black, Asian, minority, ethnic community, that all ethnic groups have a worse vaccine take-up than white adults. This is despite efforts to put out films, to take buses with messages. How does that make you feel?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that we have battled with. It's not just in the vaccine rollout, actually also in clinical trials, it was a problem. Because, you know, the vaccine registry, I mentioned the half a million people, our ethnic uptake is around 7% at the moment of that 500,000, nowhere near representative of the population. So this in itself is a huge challenge. So I do feel passionately about this. And the only way that we can combat it is by putting the information that is out there so that, you know, like myself, you know, I wanted to take a vaccine, but I wanted to know that it had also been tested on people like myself before I took it. So that was important to me. That's why we want people from different groups to actually take part in research, so that there is more confidence when it's time for rollout, when people say, actually, this was tested on people just like myself. So it's not just about everyone taking part in research, but also people from different ethnic groups who really do need to step up and play a role and take part in clinical research, because otherwise we'll be testing it on groups of people and then not rolling it out to people who it should be tested on. So that's absolutely important. But I do feel passionately about this because even within my own family, when I ask people to take part in clinical research, my own family go, "Oh, you know, am I going to be the guinea pig? Is it just because I'm Asian, I'm going to be the guinea pig?" And for me to be able to explain that that's not the case, you know, I get asked questions such as, "Oh, you've done these clinical trials really fast. I'm not quite sure." It saddens me because actually part of my role, a big part of my role, was to unblock all the blockers, was to make things happen faster. Could I have done this faster? Absolutely. Looking back, we could have streamlined other things. Should I have been doing it faster? Absolutely. But no corners were cut. And I think this is the crux. It's all about people's perceptions and changing hearts and minds of people, which is really, really difficult to do. Because, you know, when I know something, but even within my own family, I have to put the message out to say, this really does need to change. You need to step up and take part in research. And we can only do that when people actually change their views or actually start having the conversation.
Have you managed to stop any members of your family who were feeling like that and get them to get jabbed? Have you had success?
Yes, there are quite a lot of people who have actually put their arm out. People now asking me questions like, "Oh, is this going to affect my fertility?" But actually asking me the questions. So it's a conversation opener, which I really, really I'm passionate about, that it's actually got people talking. Well, and that's the important bit.
Families are definitely talking, but I think to have someone in your family's received an OBE for their role on the UK Vaccine Task Force, and then to have them to ask the questions of is probably quite an interesting conversation around the dinner table, I imagine. And thank you for giving us a glimpse into that and talking to us this morning.
Thank you so much, Emma.
Divya Chadamanik there, with her role and what that had meant, and also on the personal front. I have to say, just before we go to our next discussion, I haven't worn knickers at any time for over 30 years. Back to this, knickers under pyjamas or not, if you're just joining us, I stumbled into this one. It's so nice. Great show, says Caroline. If you go to bed after a shower or bath, then no knickers, obviously. But I'm with you, Emma. Knickers every time. And more coming in. Joe says, knickers every time. Maybe it's a northern thing. Yes. Are you a Mancunian as well, Joe? As they keep you cozy and warm. Exactly. I'm permanently cold. And yes, to those who got in touch saying you were worried about my thyroid, it's fine. I did check. Don't want my pajama bottoms need washing every day, or PJ bums as you call them, either. No, of course not. And a brilliant message here, because it includes one of my favourite words, gusset. While we're talking about knickers, please can you do some research and report on gusset positioning? Most are in the wrong place and don't serve their function, even in the posher brands. No name on that message. Fantastic question. I'll personally take that upon myself. See, you have one debate, it leads to another. That's the beauty here of what you're doing with me on Women's Hour. Now, let's talk about what we can do to support each other in the workplace, because we had a very interesting discussion a couple of weeks ago around how training courses in the workplace may or may not be serving their purpose when it comes to discrimination and through to much more serious cases of sexual harassment. We actually started that conversation around the House of Lords, and we had Michael Heseltine on, Lord Heseltine, the former Deputy Prime Minister, who wasn't convinced of the course that he had been forced to do. Today, we want to focus on the idea of men not just refraining from making unwanted advances and comments, but actually becoming active supporters of the women that they work with, away from courses, but also courses being a part of that, perhaps. This means challenging behaviours that disadvantage female colleagues, from interrupting women in meeting to making assumptions about career opportunities women want. Have you had a friend at work, a male friend who's got on side with you, helped you perhaps in certain circumstances? Maybe you describe yourself as one. We have many male listeners. Or is there something holding you back from stepping up to be a supporter? Keen to hear your views as always. 84844. Here at Ali, leadership trainer and author of a new book called Her Allies, and Gary Ford, who's just co-written The Accidental Sexist, a handbook for men on workplace diversity and inclusion, both join me now. I wondered, Gary, if I could start with you to check what qualifies you to write such a handbook. Were you an accidental sexist?
Yes, morning, Emma. I guess to some extent I probably was. I think we're all the victims of a certain amount of cultural conditioning, which means we judge women and men slightly differently. My story starts about 6 years ago. I was a managing director at JP Morgan, and I worked within IT, and we were trying to look at the reasons why very few women chose careers in technology. Typically in the UK and the US, it's less than one in five. And we, so I found myself in a room with, as the only man, with 50 women trying to explore, you know, what was going on. And as some of the women described some of the challenges and barriers that they were encountering with their careers, I began to realize that a lot of this had not been visible to me. And I've been actually quite ignorant about some of the things that were happening. So I've kind of felt that I was part of the problem. Unless I sort of changed the way I kind of worked with my colleagues, this was going to carry on happening. And it also occurred to me that there were many men that needed to have a similar conversation and be exposed to similar things that previously hadn't been visible. So myself, Stephen, who's one of my co-authors on the book, and a number of very talented men and women got together, and we talked about this idea of a Male Allies program, where we would try to deliberately make that invisible kind of barriers to women's careers visible to men, and start having a conversation about that.
So I was going to say, to bring in here at this point, but here are some examples. For instance, presuming a woman doesn't want to travel because she's got children, or presuming she might want to be in a certain part of the job than other areas. What do you make of this, Hera?
Good morning, Emma. So I think it's very important to clarify rather than assuming, and just sort of, because I think we have these preconceived notions about what women can do and what women can't do, and we have relegated women to specific industries, and we believe there are certain roles which women are meant to be for, as a result of which, when it comes to choosing women for promotions or any other opportunities, we tend to be very fixated about that. And I think it's important to step back and also flip it and test it. I mean, would you be asking a man about this? I mean, would you be asking the same question if it was a man in question? And if not, then perhaps you should give women a chance too and ask her if she's comfortable. I mean, yes, women who have recently delivered a baby, new moms, it is difficult for them, but then every situation is different. Maybe perhaps that woman does have opportunities or does have help and she is able to travel. So rather than assuming, just sort of going ahead and asking and stepping up to make sure that you're not making the wrong decision or assumption.
But I suppose these are the questions you'd like people to have in their minds, not make assumptions, ask the questions, think differently. But Gary, there's a whole other thing going on here where you'd have to get certainly men to want to participate in this. And, you can do so by trying to make it open and do what you're doing with programmes. But how do you get men to think, I would like to actually step up, especially because I'm just aware of last week there was a report which talked about mediocre male managers doing better in the workplace than women because they know how to navigate work politics. So they might, you know, walk the walk, may talk the talk, but will they actually walk the walk if it's going to jeopardise their career?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a conversation that needs to be had about, you know, what's in it for men. And I do feel that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, clearly a lot of research and evidence showing that a more gender equal workplace and a more gender equal society is better for everyone, men included. And I think, you know, traditionally, given there are multiple genders, I think one particular gender, my gender, I identify as a man, haven't been doing their fair share of the work. So I do think there's a conversation that says this will make you better at what you do. You will probably be better as a manager if you are a manager. You will basically work in teams that are more motivated. They will deliver better products and services.
So that's what's in it for men, just slightly aware of our time. How do you actually call it out? Let me go to Hera first. Hera, if you see something in the workplace, how do you call it out?
There are lots of different ways to call it out because, you know, with men especially, there's a long-standing bro code which is difficult to violate and men are often hesitant. I would say just by saying that if somebody is being interrupted in the meeting, just pausing and saying, let her finish the sentence, or can I hear her viewpoint, or let everybody speak up. Or if you hear a sexist comment, just stepping up and say, well, you know, we don't do this here, or that was, oh, ouch, did you just say that? Or asking the person to reflect. So lots of different strategies in which you don't have to be directly confrontational or assertive, but at the same time, you can respectfully call out the behavior and make sure the person is forced to reflect and not repeat that again.
Well, how would you do it, Gary?
I think there's a couple of things, really. I mean, I think there's certainly a need to practice this type of behaviour. Actually calling someone out and being called out are actually quite difficult things to do. So I do think recommending that people practice this, maybe in a safe space with other colleagues. And also, we all make mistakes.
How do you practice that? What, somebody says a sexist remark and then the other person goes, excuse me, you can't say that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jill, one of my other co-authors on the book, and I have run workshops around this where we try to role play. So what would you say, right? And make some suggestions about how you step in. And more importantly, if you are called out, because we all make mistakes, how you deal with that. You don't get defensive. You don't say, oh, you must have got it wrong. I was just joking. But you try and treat it with the respect it deserves. And I think one of the most powerful things any leader in an organization can do is give the people that work in their organization permission to call them out, to say quite publicly, I will make mistakes. And if I do say something that makes you feel uncomfortable or you feel is not appropriate, then please let me know. You have my permission to do that. And I would try to do better next time. So I do think if you can lead from the front on this, that can make a real difference.
But what about benevolent sexism? Nice guy misogyny is also a nickname, where you don't even know there's an issue and maybe it's a male-dominated firm and there's only a couple of women. They're not going to start role-playing that, are they, Gary?
They're not. I mean, and a bit like Hera, we saw plenty of examples where people would make assumptions about, you know, the careers that they were, the women that worked with them wanted to have. So I think some of this, again, is back to making it visible, having appropriate conversations, try not to make people feel guilty about this. We're all conditioned by some of these sort of cultural stereotypes and begin to kind of co-create. I do see this as men and women and other genders working together collectively on this, but beginning to have conversations about what we can all do differently and get men talking about it and realize that, you know, they have a view. They've been traditionally silenced on this subject. But let's hear what they've got to say.
Hera, you've worked in a completely male-dominated space where I imagine this wouldn't have been something that anyone was open to.
No, definitely not. And you know what, Emma? The interesting part is most of them are well-intentioned men and they don't realise when they do engage in benevolent sexism. So seemingly innocuous compliments, which are meant to be well. I mean, I meant well, I was just complimenting you. Or just snide remarks which are couched in sexist humour. And I think what is challenging is most of the sexist comments are delivered with humour. And research shows that when you deliver a sexist comment with humour, then the chances of being called out are going to be that much less. Or the chances of being confronted are that much less.
Have you had somebody in your career? I mean, because the other side of this, I'm just looking at some of the messages coming in here. Have you had someone who's done this with you, a guy who's spoken up for you? Because some people are also finding that whole idea quite sexist, that you might need a man in a meeting to say, hang on a minute, she's not finished her point. Very quickly, Hera.
Yes, so not as many as I would have liked to have, but generally speaking, I mean, I'm able to say that myself and I'm able to say, let me finish it. But when I researched women, a lot of women did say that if they had anybody who could intervene, then that would have been far more helpful for them.
And that would have been something they would have taken. Hera Ali, thank you very much. Her new book's called Her Allies. Gary Ford, thank you to you, who's just co-written The Accidental Sexist. And thank you to you for your company. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Are you fed up
with the news?
As you know, I'm
fed up.
People are fed up.
Next slide, please.
The Skewer.
The Skewer.
The Skewer.
The news chopped and channeled.
Welcome to the repair shop. In the repair shop today, Matt needs help with a cherished possession.
What have you brought us?
A National Health Service.
Oh, dear.
It's everything you need to know.
Like you've never heard it before.
Have you ever dabbled in an animal?
I haven't said no.
You've tried?
Donkeys.
Dating.
Appears we had a good time at university.
The biggest story.
Next. With a twist.
Suddenly, thank God, Spider-Man came in and said,
"My defense is tingling."
Spider-Man quite rightly was saying,
"Tank fly, boss walk, jam, nitty gritty." You're listening to the
Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty.
Jam
by John Holmes,
Anna. Crack team of
sound wizards.
Kate Winslet has saved the Health Secretary Matt Hancock from the jaws of a crocodile by punching it in the face.
Suppliers of racist and sexist tweets are struggling to meet demand.
Multi-award-winning satirical comedy.
Order. Did you link? Scott, man.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy Speaker.
Scott,
Sorry, you sound like a Dalek. Barry Gardner.
You are an enemy of the Daleks.
Video link, Paul Blomfield.
I'll be back.
We'll try and get you
the
back.
Skewer. The skewer. The skewer.
Oh,
listen now on BBC Sounds.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.